Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, gather around the radio. It's time now for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. My name is Michael Harris, and it's my privilege to serve as anchor of the program. It's an ensemble show, lots of good people involved, and the host and founder of the program is Carol Marks. Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues, and she's a champion in the battle against ageism. Let's kick the program off right now with Carol Marks in conversation with Dr. Carl Pillemer. He's a Ph.D. He's one of America's leading family sociologists and researchers on aging, and he's going to talk about the results of his marriage advice project and his new book titled 30 Lessons for Loving, Advice from the Wisest Americans on Love, Relationships, and Marriage. It's published by Hudson Street Press.
Now, how did a chance encounter with an extraordinary 90-year-old woman make you begin to wonder what older people knew about life that the rest of us just don't know?
You know, I that whole thing started a bit when I realized I'd been a gerontologist, you know, somebody who studies older people, for close to 30 years. And suddenly it hit me, and I think this relates to a lot of the work you two have done. It struck me that my work was basically all about the problems of older people. Alzheimer's disease, elder abuse, chronic pain, and that's the way our society looks at older people too, as problems. At the same time, I was meeting happy, vibrant, healthy people in their 80s and 90s, and I was reading the research that shows that older people are happier than younger people. So it started to hit me, is there something older people know about living a happy and more fulfilling life or that younger people don't? And right at that moment, I had an amazing conversation with a very impaired but incredibly positive nursing home resident during one of my studies, and she kind of turned me around. I really wanted to learn how somebody who was having immense difficulties still had this positive, joyous attitude about life. Could I find that out and distill it and make it available for young people? And I wasn't disappointed. These studies have, I think, pointed the way in that direction.
This book, 30 Lessons for Loving, is the result of your latest project, which was the Marriage Advice Project. And doesn't it follow an earlier book, 30 Lessons for Living, when you looked and asked older adults about life in general, and now your research led you to find out about marriage and relationships in particular?
Exactly right, you know, and I have to say I owe this second book really to the readers of the first book. In that first book, among a lot of other advice, was one short chapter on the elders' lessons for having a happy marriage. I kept on hearing again and again from people, we'd really like a whole book on that because it's important enough and interesting enough. I actually heard from people who bought that first book just for the chapter on marriage. So I was glad that people continued to nag me about it because it turned out to be another great adventure, you know, to talk to people in their 80, 90, and 100 who'd been married 50, 60, 70 years. It was quite a thing.
And with your research, did you interview people at random, and did they come from a huge variety of backgrounds?
It was a very diverse sample, so we, in fact, did do something unusual, which is a national random sample survey, so where you got a true mix of the whole population, but we still used in-depth, long interviews, often lasting an hour. We also created a sample that included older African Americans, Hispanics, Asians, and some people in long-term same-sex relationships, too. So it is a sample as diverse as America's elders. It's not just a study of healthy, completely successful, you know, people with wonderful lives. It's both folks who for whom marriage worked out well and some people for whom it didn't work out so well. And I think that's one of the unique things about the book.
And that's why the research is so helpful. Now, when it comes to elders, and you call them the wisest Americans, were you surprised to say about the qualities that you should look for in someone that you want to marry? I mean, what was the basic thing that they said that you should look for?
So, you know, I was afraid, Carol, when I started this book that I would just get a bunch of empty platitudes and cliches, and so much of what people talked about was really surprised me. But one of the things they say for a young person or even an older person looking for a partner is that we have a mistaken belief, they say, that opposites attract. They say opposites may attract initially, but for a long-term relationship, you really need to be very similar. that is someone who's similar in background, in beliefs, and in particular core values. And that's one place where elder wisdom maps onto research. People do find that, more similar people tend to have an easier time with marriage. So I would say that's one example in terms of finding a partner. You know, they also say that love is incredibly important and you should never get married without love and passion, but that friendship has to become as important as love if you're going to be in a relationship for a long time. In fact, that's another good insight, because we often think that love and friendship are very different animals. They say you've got to have both or you aren't going to make it to a 60 or 70 year finish line.
And you know, I think that finding is so right. Now, your research came up with something that a lot of us unfortunately try to do, and that is we try to change our partner, his bad habits or whatever we don't like, after marriage, and that doesn't prove to be a very productive thing to do.
You know, in general, the elders I talked to were very polite and very measured in what they said. On that one issue, people banged their fists on the table and used expressions like idiotic, dumb, stupid. From their own experience, observing their children and their grandchildren, if there's one thing they believe, it's that we all have to stop trying to change our partners. Our partners may change, they say, but not because we want them to. And they feel that especially going into a relationship with the idea that you're going to change your partner, that he's going to lose weight or she's going to like your family more or he's going to want to have kids, they say that's a fool's errand, that your number one task has to be to accept your partner as is, and if you don't consider getting married. And they were as strong about that as anything else. They had lived through it themselves, and it's something they deeply believe.
Now, Carl, were you also surprised that most of the older Americans you interviewed had such a positive view about aging, even when they had some serious chronic illnesses?
You know, it was one of the most positive messages of both the books, and I think it's really consonant, you know, with your radio program, et cetera, that tries to give that same message. One of their strongest messages for young people is, yes, aging can be difficult, it can be hard, but it's much better than most young people think it's going to be. That it's a time of new opportunities, of new experiences. A lot of people told me they feel freer. Their thinking is clearer, that they understand their priorities more. So a lot of what they said about aging was, don't be so afraid of it, and don't worry about anti-aging products, because there's a tremendous enjoyment and potential. And this isn't people just saying platitudes, it's people who are living it. So I was left in both these projects with a way more positive idea of the later years of life. And as somebody who just turned 60 myself, it's very good news.
Absolutely. And I think that one of the innovative and really important things that you did was to include in this study a focus group, really, of younger people to find out what they would like to know from elders 80 and beyond. And what were some of the questions that the young focus groups came up with? I thought they were really right on target.
It was really fun. I sat with brothers of a fraternity, you know, young working women, and asked them, what would you like to know about love and marriage from the oldest Americans? Here's what I really learned, and surveys show the same thing. Young people want a lot of the same things about out of marriage that people did 50 and 100 years ago. Almost all of them want to get married. They would like to get married for life, and they would like to stay faithful to one person, which surprises some people, you know, but attitudes about marriage haven't changed much among young people. So that was a very important thing. You know, they really wanted to know, how do I find a person who's right for me? How do I communicate well? How do I avoid conflict? And perhaps most important, how do we keep the spark alive for 50, 60, 70 years? So I think that's why the book has resonated with them, that they have many of the same questions, I don't know, perhaps even going back to Jane Austen's time, that people have had, you know.
And so talking about having the same questions that people had a couple of hundred years ago, what about the future? If there was a sequel to the book, say 50 years from now, do you think the lessons would be completely different, or they'd be largely the same?
You know, that is a terrific question. I mean, the one thing that the folks I interviewed have, in a way, is they experienced a lot of the things that younger people are experiencing in terms of technological change, and different kinds of social upheaval and economic problems. So it's why these 20-year-olds, in some ways, have more in common with the experience of their grandparents than their own parents because of the way social conditions are. So I think it's going to depend what changes over those 70 years. The one thing I learned from this book and from studies of marriage is that marriage is, for a lot of people, a very, very good thing. It promotes health, promotes social integration, and promotes psychological well-being. It's possible that we'll develop other kind of social mechanisms for that. It's hard for me to imagine something that works as well as marriage is when it does. I won't be around in 70 years, but maybe 30 years from now I can do a sequel to this.
That's Dr. Carl Pillemer. He's a PhD, and his book is titled 30 Lessons for Loving, Advice from the Wisest Americans on Love, Relationships, and Marriage, published by Hudson Street Press. The interview was conducted by the host of our program, Carol Marks. If you want more information, go to marriagelegacy.org. That's marriagelegacy.org. We're going to stay on the theme of seasoned citizens giving advice on love and romance. I'll be talking with an amazing woman, Eve Pell, about her new book. It's called Love Again, The Wisdom of Unexpected Romance, published by Ballantine Books. That's next when A Touch of Grey continues.
More than 1 million wild animals are killed each year illegally. Poaching is a major threat to our country's wildlife. I'm Tom Barry. I'm an actor with a desire to preserve living space for wildlife. The Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust does just that. Works with private landowners to protect wildlife, to preserve natural habitats. To learn more or to work with the Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust, call 800-729-SAVE. That's 800-729-SAVE or visit wildlifelandtrust.org. Thank you.
Continuing now with A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and I recently had the opportunity to speak with Eve Pell. She's in her 70s. She's an award-winning writer. She's an investigative reporter. She's a great lady, and she's pretty darn smart. And she's sharing those smarts in her new book. She'll talk about the book. It's titled Love Again, The Wisdom of Unexpected Romance, published by Ballantine. Eve, it's a pleasure to have you on the program, and I want to congratulate you on the critical acclaim and the success. Your brand new book, published by Ballantine Hardcover, Love Again, The Wisdom of Unexpected Romance, is getting. Everybody seems to like it, and it is about what it says, unexpected romance, loving again, and so apropos for our program, which is aimed at the upper demographic. Romance can, in fact, be quite sweet in the later years of life. What led to this book? And tell us a bit about your view of romance in the senior years.
Well, it started with my own experience. I am not a woman who was either lucky or good at love in younger years. I had a couple of divorces, and so two ex-husbands, and then some not-husbands along the way. And when I was 67, I was single and kind of looking. I'm a competitive runner. There was a man in my running club who I liked, but he was 10 years older, Japanese-American, quite conservative, and I didn't know how to approach him exactly, not the kind of guy you could walk up to and say, hey, you're cute, let's date. So through a friend of mine, she organized an event where we both were going to be, and he asked me to a movie after that, and we fell madly in love. And nobody had ever suggested to me that at 67, and he was 77, such a romance would be possible.
Eve, to what do you attribute the lack of success in the earlier romances and the earlier relationships? And what has changed in you to make you more prone and predisposed to have a successful romance at this point in life?
Well, I come from a family where marriage is like voting in Boston, early and often. A lot of divorces, fair amount of insecurity. And so I don't think I really had, with due apologies to my late parents, very good models of how to make a lasting romance. There were a lot of situations I didn't handle very well. So I would say it was experience and some good therapy that helped me. And then the other thing that was so wonderful was my, as it turned out, third husband, Sam Hirabayashi, who was a thorough grown-up, who knew how to love, who knew how to have a good relationship. He was a widower after almost 50 years of a nice marriage. So I think you add all those things up, and a little bit of learning along the way, and some great women friends, and I think that made it possible for me to do something I hadn't done before.
I see. Now, do you think that this is a syndrome that happens all around in terms of a lot of people, that people are just getting married at too young an age?
I don't know if it's that they're getting married too young an age, although I think particularly for women, a lot of us don't really figure out who we are until we're into our 30s, and by that time you can be in a marriage with some kids and wake up and think, ooh, this isn't really what I want. That's part of it. And then the other thing I think is that divorce has, I think half of all marriages end in divorce, and it's just become a very common phenomenon, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in some ways it's good that at least we have a society that's open enough to let people divorce. At one time it was such a stigma on it that people would stay together and be miserable, living lives of quiet desperation. But it just seems to me that it takes, and we cover this theme so much on this program, it takes years and years of going around the track a few times to know who you are, what you want, what you're looking for in someone else. It just seems that so many younger people get married and have no idea what they're going to face. They'll spend tremendous amount of effort, as much as a year, putting on the wedding, and think that's what the marriage is.
Well, it's interesting. As you know, this romance and marriage of mine, I wrote a column about it for the New York Times Modern Love section, and then Ballantine Books offered me a book contract to do a piece about myself and other couples who've fallen in love when they're old. And there's a chapter in the book essentially about what's different from love when you're old from love when you're young. And some of the people basically say, you know, I wasn't ready, I didn't know, I didn't really know how to have a good relationship where doesn't become oppositional and you don't sort of fight with one another and you have a good sense of proportion about what truly matters. Those people are to me interesting on exactly this point that you are raising, which is, I think, a very important one.
How do you feel about people that decide to wait, particularly women, who forego having the children and forego pleasing their parents and forego the pressure of society and wait until they're 40 or 50 or even 60 to get married? You hear a lot about people getting married for the first time after 50. Any comment on that?
Well, I admire them. I think they're, you know, I think they're, as long as they're doing what they're doing and it's their choice, I think they're great. There's certainly enough people in the world. There's no need to populate it with more children unless that's what you truly want to do. And I think actually of the most famous alumna almost of the college that I went to, Bryn Mawr, was Katharine Hepburn, who basically said that she did not have enough strength or energy to have both a good career and a good marriage, and she opted for the career. And though we know she had some romances along the way, she really had her priorities straight, and they suited her.
Interesting indeed. Now, let's talk about the word romance, because the word romance, I find, is a very, very crucial concept when thinking about this. I don't think a lot of people really understand what romance is. And when you get older, whatever you think of romance as being, it certainly is clearer, more defined, and more easy to recognize, and thus to embellish and to nourish. What do you see, just personally, as a woman of the world, when you talk about you have a romance with this new gentleman in your life? What do you see as being romantic? And part two, do you think we don't have enough? It's kind of a leading question, but do you think there's not enough romance in our culture so people even are inspired to be romantic?
It's obviously, as you know and have found out in all your conversations, probably the difference of romance varies from individual to individual. I mean, partly though, I think at bottom, it's someone who makes you feel wonderful. And that can happen in any of several different ways, but if someone makes you feel terrific, it's very romantic. And for me, it's a mixture of humor and looks, not necessarily standardly movie star handsome looks, but a kind of an attitude that comes through as kind of confident but open and warm. But it has a lot to do with me, with laughter and fun and getting the same kind of jokes and having some of the same kind of attitudes and values. It's also someone, I guess, who is vital and alive. That has a lot to do with it too.
No doubt.
How about that for a
set
of ingredients.
Well, yeah. But if you look for it, you can find it. Sometimes people don't know what to look for. I have one final question for you, and that is, what about giving? I find when I talk to people about their love lives and their dating and their romance, people of all ages, it's what they get. This one, as you even said, makes me feel good. Somebody who's good to me, somebody who, me, and I'm certainly not accusing you of that because I have a feeling you understand every aspect of this. And that's why I'm asking you, what about going into the relationship concerned about what you bring to the table for the other person?
Well, here's a slightly indirect answer to what you're saying. I believe fully that if the people have not only, the people have an urge to love as well as an urge to be loved. I think you don't just want to be the recipient, and have someone else do all the giving. You want to give too. You have a person, you see needs, you can fill those needs perhaps, and that makes you feel terrific.
That's
so
a good point.
I think there's a great deal to be said on the giving side of it, but I think where you're right is people don't tell you exactly the pleasures of that giving, and that's something that you kind of find out for yourself.
That's Eve Pell in conversation with yours truly, Michael Harrison, and the book is titled Love Again, The Wisdom of Unexpected Romance, published by Ballantine Hardcover. Coming up next, we're going to talk to Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine. And that's next, when A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups, continues. Last week and the week before, I played a track called Everything Passes at this point in the program by a group called Gun Hill Road. They have an album kind of interestingly titled Every 40 Years. This group of fellows in their 60s had not recorded since the early 70s when they had a hit. You may remember it, Back When My Hair Was Short, a couple of albums. They were a hot rock band in their early 20s. Now they're in their mid-60s, and they came back and made an album of 19 tracks called Every 40 Years, and it stands as a testament to the idea that it's never too late to follow your passion and relive your youthful dreams and do it even better the second time around. Here's a song that's very appropriate to today's economy by Gun Hill Road from this new album. It's called Selling Apples.
Street. and stocks. And even if the banks won't give you money, honey, I've got two strong arms to lend. And baby, we could be happy selling apples again.
Isn't that just a great song? Three guys in their 60s, used to be rock stars back in their 20s, came back 40 years later. The album is called Every 40 Years, kind of an interesting title. It's Glenn Leopold, lead singer, he wrote the song, and Steve Goldrich and Paul Reich. They're Gun Hill Road, Every 40 Years, the song Selling Apples. And if you're interested in Gun Hill Road, it's a great album, 19 tracks, all kind of new stuff from old guys, and they're really, really seasoned. Lovely, lovely album. You can get it at GunHillRoadMusic.com. GunHillRoadMusic.com. You're listening to A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. Continuing now with A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. This is the point in the program where we are joined by Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine, the trade publication in the talk radio business. In addition to being a senior correspondent here on A Touch of Grey, Kevin Casey is the vice president and executive editor of Talkers Magazine. And, Kevin, there has been kind of a romantic theme to this program so far.
Mm-hmm.
And we're one weekend ahead of Valentine's Day. And, you know, it's funny, right after Christmas, Valentine's stuff wound up being in all the stores. And I don't know. I mean, I love romance. I think romance is great. I'm all for it. Some people have different views of it. To me, it's a driving force in life, not just man-woman romance, romance about your passions and feelings for everything. And yet, the commercialization of romance is only one notch on the bad taste scale in my mind to the commercialization of religion. How do you feel about romance and Valentine's Day?
I'm not a fan of it. I think that most of it is faked. I think that most men, not that they don't have romantic feelings about their significant others, but that, for example, Valentine's Day, I think most men, 90-something percent, look at it and go, oh, God, Valentine's Day, that's right. And I'm willing to bet you a fair amount of women are always disappointed in the holiday as well. And it's the phony romance where you're supposed to pretend to be more excited about something or show it in a way that you don't usually on one day of the year is goofy to me.
Yeah, well, that's the way I look at it. I look at it that if you're forced to do it, it doesn't have the same meaning as if you did it without
right.
being forced. Like you bring your wife or your girlfriend flowers or chocolate or candy, you look into her eyes, you tell her how beautiful it is, you take her for dinner, and it's just any night of the week. That's
yeah,
very different.
Now, there are some women who would, of course, say, yeah, if there wasn't a special day, then you'd never do it.
Well, then she married the wrong guy. She should have married me.
Well, that's what this holiday does. This holiday goes to, in some way, preserve the pretense of the man who doesn't really want to do it anyway.
We've got about 15 seconds. Tell me, so that we fit our requirements in terms of what the show's all about, has anybody been talking about this on the talk stations? Is Valentine's Day and romance and man-woman relations?
It's discussed, but not to a large degree. It doesn't come up the way it does usually on music stations.
Got it. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us. That's Kevin Casey, Vice President and Executive Editor of Talkers Magazine. You want to know more about what's going on behind the scenes in talk radio? Go to talkers.com. I'm Michael Harrison, and we're going to be talking with a legend in the television writing industry, a man who has been behind some of the biggest shows of all time. He's brilliant, and it's going to be a pleasure to have him on. His name is Dennis Klein. That's next when A Touch of Gray continues.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. The National Institute of Mental Health reports elderly depression to be a serious public health problem. Recent research shows 15% of persons over 60, or roughly 6.5 million Americans, are suffering from depression, while 25% state they suffer from sadness. Health practitioners that care and treat the elderly, including primary care physicians, are unprepared to detect and diagnose depression. Let's review depression's warning signs. Are you experiencing feelings of helplessness or sadness, most of the time lasting 2 weeks or longer? Have family members, friends noticed social withdrawal, self-neglect with personal hygiene, appearance, clothing, loss of appetite, weight loss, and maybe dehydration? Has your physical pain increased? Has there been a major loss, illness, or surgery recently? If any of these scenarios exist, an evaluation by a qualified MD is recommended. Successful treatment of depression would include both psychotherapy and medications. I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at PremierGeriatricRN.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. I recently had the opportunity to talk with a real television writer, a legend in the television writing field. His name is Dennis Klein. He has been involved in some of the biggest shows of all time. He was the co-creator of The Larry Sanders Show, which many of you know is one of the most celebrated programs of all time. Back in the 90s, in the 70s, he was the creative force behind Mary Hartman. He's been involved with Buffalo Bill. He was one of the people that rewrote some of the segments of Men in Black. This guy is a genius. And he's kind of a eclectic thinking man, and I'd never met him before, but I've been following his career. And I recently interviewed him in an extensive interview for a podcast that delves into the media. Along the way, I sort of fell into an aspect of his life that I said I must share with our listeners on A Touch of Gray. And it has to do with somebody in their seasoned, you know, mature years, as we are, looking back at their life and reevaluating or just contemplating how they raised their child, which is something we all think about, those of us who are over 50 years old and the target, of course, of this program. So I fell into that conversation with Dennis Klein, and I have taken the liberty of sharing that aspect of a media discussion with our audience here on A Touch of Gray. Here now is that segment. The changes from the 20th century to the 21st century are just profound, and they seem to be moving faster and faster and faster. I've even referred to people who spent most of their life in the 20th century as immigrants from the old country here in the new country of the digital age.
Yeah.
Things are
yeah.
changing so much. How has the media business, particularly television, network television, sitcoms, to a certain degree, movies, the culture of the industry, the people in the industry, being in the industry, the product of the industry, as succinctly as you can, how have they changed over these past couple of decades or three decades, even four decades that you've been actively writing big-time stuff?
Well, I may not be that great an authority on it, because for the last 18 years I've been a dad to my daughter and hardly working at all in the entertainment field. So I don't know about the real changes have taken place in the last 10 or 20 years. I think that, but you see, and I don't know, and I got rid of my television when she was little because I didn't want her watching television. And I didn't want to say, hey, daddy can watch television because that's his field. You know, I think she correctly read that as hypocrisy. Maybe I'll pass on that question. Let me think for a moment if I have anything to say about it.
Well, actually, you just brought up something more interesting than my question, and that is, why would you get rid of television, having such roots in television, and being such a part of major milestones in television in this chapter of your life, where another equally fascinating thing you brought up is that you've devoted these years to raising a daughter. We'll put that aside for a second as I try to put all the elements of this conversation in my responsibility as the as the facilitator of
good
this
luck.
And dealing with a free-form guy like you who can go off in any direction and never stop. So I'm going to pull you back in. And why would you not have your kid watch television?
Because it's because the pace of it is was and is so fast, and all the coarseness of it, the coarseness of the shows and the commercials, and I wanted her to be a human being at a human pace. This probably refers back to something you said earlier. The television world, the media world, is not really human. It's about entertainment, but it's not done at a human rate of speed or volume or even concern. People's things that have people's feelings get hurt normally. That gets said, you know, somebody says something to somebody that's really horrible, and then everybody laughs, maybe if it's a comedy, and nobody addresses the fact that this is terrible or this person is awful. I mean, look at people in the early, my field mostly is half-hour comedy. People in the early days of television, those classic shows of Lucy, which I never liked, but let's say The Honeymooners and Bilko and Amos and Andy, these are people that I would not want ever in my life. I wouldn't want to have them in my life. They're very disturbing and disturbed people, and I wouldn't want them in my life for, like, let's say 31 minutes or longer. But for 30 minutes, I not only accept them in my life, I enjoy them completely, but mainly because I can then turn them off. I know that I'm not going to have to sit and watch for 24 hours. But even if I did, maybe I'd like that. But maybe the television provides a distance. But so that stuff, if people take it in, and as they do a lot of time, and especially for a child who's a year old or 2 years old or 3 years old, that resembles the way life is or life should be, and it's, I think it's awful. I think it's really awful.
Bilko.
I didn't realize this before I had a child.
Yeah.
But then one day I was walking. My daughter Emma was at a friend of hers' house, and I didn't see what she was doing. I didn't see that she was watching television, but I saw her sitting in his room, and I saw her in her face the way I've never seen it before or since. And she was slack jawed and looked really stupid. She looked like somebody with a, you know, 15 or 20 IQ. And then I kind of leaned in and I saw that she was like 2 years old or something, maybe a year. And I saw that she was watching Barney. And I thought, Jesus Christ, I don't know what this is reducing. It's not just that she looks that way. I think she's losing brain cells here, it just seems to me, or would continue to if I had any of this in the house. We didn't say, like, no television. It's just that television wasn't a part of our house.
Mm.
Just like cookies and cakes and candies and stuff for the first couple of months, which turned into 2 years of her life, she didn't know they existed. And then I took her to her first two-year-old birthday party, and she came out of the car when I picked her up later, and she said, Dad, they had something at that party. It was round and hard, and when I bit into it, it was sweet. I forgot what it's called. I said, I think you're talking about a cookie. And she said, yeah, that's right, cookie. It was a cookie. Can we have those at home? I said, absolutely, honey. I didn't want to keep her in a bubble. But at least she spent the first 2 years not knowing what anything sweet, you know.
Well, there is the danger of the bubble. I mean, one of the hardest things about raising a child today, and I agree with you that our society has become coarsened. More so, coarsening doesn't bother me as much because I'm really into free speech and I like edgy art. So I am no goody two-shoes in terms of my language and in terms of things that I explore. But I certainly understand that some things are in good taste, some things are in bad taste, and some things are downright destructive. But repression is also destructive. But I think that, yeah, there's no easy answers and there's no easy balance. But in raising a child, you're faced with the difficulty of trying to instill values that are your values into this child, and to raise the child in a way that you think is intelligent, decent, and positive, productive, while not putting the child in a situation, one where they're going to rebel against you, because it seems as though the society in which we operate conspires against raising a child that way, does everything it can to undermine your efforts, and you run the risk of turning your child into an outcast. One of the things that children seem to need more than anything, and it's how we're wired as human beings, is acceptance. You know, we're a social animal. You have to be accepted. Do you remember when you were a kid how important it was that you got along and were accepted? And that you fit in. I mean, this is the whole conundrum of the human condition, is fitting in while maintaining individuality. Sometimes we all do the same thing so we can all be individuals the same. Like my high school yearbook, and where we all were nonconformists and we looked exactly alike back in the 60s. We all looked exactly alike. And we all thought we were nonconformists because we didn't look like the other group that all looked exactly alike. So it's a tough battle to raise a kid under those conditions, and I find it interesting, and certainly we're not going to dwell too much on it in this conversation, but I find it interesting that this seems to be one of the central themes of your life. And I applaud you for
when
that.
When you say this, what do you mean by this? Just so I know what you're saying.
This meaning the fact that you're talking about spending 18 years raising a child, and that your concern for this child's well-being has caused you to reevaluate your own position on media and art and culture that you have been such a major part of creating, portraying, and instigating.
Yeah, but it hasn't caused me. Well, wait, it hasn't caused me to change any of that. Mm. It's affected me actually in those terms. It really has. And the holiday, the 18-year holiday I took from being narcissistic, has opened me up to being more interested in things other than how am I doing, how am I feeling today. So that has changed. But I don't think other than that the raising of Emma changed me so much as that everything I was thinking before I was able to put into practice in terms of. And thinking about throughout my life, including as when I was a child, I remember being in a crib and holding the bars and saying, really thinking to myself, what crime did I commit that has me, you know, stuck in here?
Wow, that's amazing.
I didn't get anything.
That's amazing.
I didn't understand anything, much of anything, really. It was
wow.
A very confusing time for me. So I finally got to put into practice raising, you know, my own child in a way that was, that was not mean, and that was loving, and had her be a winner, but be somebody that's on top of the world rather than under it, or under my thumb, or under the thumb of NBC and CBS and ABC.
And there you have a segment of a conversation that I conducted with the legendary Dennis Klein, a television writer of great renown, for a media conversation in another platform that we wound up talking about reassessing, reevaluating, look back at how we raise our children and how we, the boomers, have raised our kids. I hope you found that as fascinating as I did. Dennis Klein. I'm Michael Harrison, and you're plugged into A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups, which continues in a moment.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only.
Retrievers, Labradors, Goldens are the main breeds that come through our door, but we'll train anything with four legs and a tail. My husband and I train hunting dogs and also have a boarding and grooming business. And our dogs, they're athletes, and we feed a very quality food. You can't get enzymes in a commercial dog food because they cook it at such a high heat, but adding Dynavite to their diet has every single dog in my kennel looking better than they have ever looked.
DINOVITE.com.
859-428-1000.
The omega-3 fatty acids.
Flaxseed, zinc, alfalfa.
The digestive enzymes that are cooked out of regular dog food.
Dynavite's the bomb.
Tell everybody we know about Dynavite.
Just feed your dog right. Use Dynavite. If it's working, don't quit.
When I get down to the bottom of my box of Dynavite, it's time to place my order.
Dynavite.com.
859-428-1000.
859-428-1000.
DINOVITE.com. Whoa, a digital music player. Thanks, Mom.
Glad you like it. We can finally toss out that old massive stereo.
Mom, you can't just throw out electronics. They need to be recycled or donated.
Recycled? Like aluminum cans?
Yeah. You just go to greenergadgets.org, enter your zip code, and it tells you where the nearest certified recycling center is.
I knew that.
Okay, Mom.
Recycling electronics is as easy as buying them. Log on to greenergadgets.org to find electronics recycling options near you.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. You may recognize the symptoms of elderly depression, loss of appetite, weight loss, social withdrawal, problems with hygiene, neglecting personal well-being, or even a sadness that lasts over 2 weeks. Sound familiar? Here's what you can do about it. Exercise, eat well, and don't forget to socialize. Researchers at Duke University suggest exercising at least 3 times a week to keep the body and mind healthy. That means swimming, walking, and maybe light exercise classes with the approval of your medical doctor. Another key to happiness is maintaining self-esteem through clubs and groups. You might consider the gardening club or a musical choir. And lastly, treat your body well and it will thank you by feeling well. That means practicing good nutrition and eating well-balanced meals daily. Naturally, the needs of patients vary, but feel free to consult a geriatric specialist to make a personalized treatment plan. I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at PremierGeriatricRN.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. We come to the final segment of this hour, and we are joined by our senior correspondent, Steve Wiseman, who is a prolific author. He's an attorney. He's an expert on so many things, and he's an all-around good guy. As a matter of fact, he is a good guy. He's a guy in the white hat. He is an enemy of scam artists and bad guys, and there are a lot of them out there in cyberspace and all over the place. As a matter of fact, he's written the book, The Truth About Avoiding Scams, published by Prentice Hall, and now his new Prentice Hall publication is the book titled Identity Theft Alert. Steve Wiseman has a website that I advise everybody visit. Its name is scamicide.com. Steve joins us now to talk about how safe is it to use a debit card as a credit card. Steve?
Thank you, Michael. You know, a lot of you are familiar with my regular refrain that you shouldn't use your debit card for anything other than an ATM card. And even then, you should really carefully examine any ATM you're considering using for evidence of tampering that can indicate whether the ATM's been tampered with and a skimmer installed on it that'll capture your account data from your card. When you shop with a credit card, whether it's online or in a brick-and-mortar store, your liability limit for fraudulent purchases is only $50, and most card issuers don't even hold you responsible for that amount of fraudulent charges. On the other hand, when you use your debit card, you're making a direct withdrawal from your bank account tied to your card. If your debit card security is breached, such as in a data breach that occurred last year at Target, Home Depot, and many others, your liability is $500 if you don't report the fraudulent use within 2 business days. But if you actually don't report it for more than 60 days after you've gotten a bank statement, and some people may not notice it, you could actually have your entire bank account emptied. So this is a real concern. But when you use that debit card, sometimes the clerk will say, is this, do you want to use this as a credit card? And here's the thing where people think if they use their debit card as a credit card, that they're going to be receiving protection. You couldn't be more wrong. A debit card is a debit card. If it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a debit card. Regardless of whether your debit card transaction is processed as a debit purchase with a PIN or as a credit card transaction without a PIN, the money's still processed as a debit card, and the funds are immediately withdrawn from your bank account. Frankly, the only difference to the consumer are the fees associated with the card use. Some banks charge you a transaction fee if you use your debit card as a debit card with a PIN for purchases, but charge the retailer a fee when the card is used for a credit card purchase. So never, and I mean never, use your debit card for anything other than an ATM card. Don't use it for purchases either in a store or online. Make your purchases by credit card only, and regularly monitor your credit card account carefully for unauthorized purchases and report them immediately. So this is the key to successful shopping. Even if you use that debit card as a credit card, it's still a debit card.
Very valuable information. Thank you very much, Steve Wiseman. Again, Steve's written The Truth About Avoiding Scams in his latest book, Identity Theft Alert, both published by Prentice Hall, and the website is scamaside.com. Thank you, Steve Wiseman. Thank you, Kevin Casey. Thank you, Beverly Santinella, our producer on the front line. And most of all, thank you, Carol Marks, the host and founder of the show. On behalf of all of us here at A Touch of Gray, I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you to join us here next weekend for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.